Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Is there a point to all this? There is a point. Let's find a point. Is there a point to my act? I would say there is. I have to. The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud. And it's fun. For a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered. They come back to us and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people.
Shut him up.
We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real. It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok. But it doesn't matter because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever. In peace.
Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is. Especially when you arrive at the virtual Alexandria to Aeon Byte. Especially on a Sunday. And I know most of you, it's Sunday, so you're working in your alchemical laboratories like any good occultist. So this show will definitely be extra useful for you. But it is good to see everybody, and I see everybody already in the chat. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your host, your psychopomp, your pompadas of Gnosis. Welcome to this age of Hermes, this Philip K. Dick world, and these Gnostic times. And with us, very excited to have for a sequel, David Pantano, who will be joining us to discuss his new book, Alchemical Hermeticism, The Secret Teachings of Marco Daffy on Initiation. There it is. There it is. A very handsome book.
There we go.
I have a copy over here myself. And yeah, David, thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Miguel. Looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise, too. And with us, too, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you and the Tech Archons doing?
I'm doing a lot better than Tech Archons. I had to turn my lead computer into gold just before we got on the air. Yeah,
that's not the only one. I looked today, as many of you know, the show streams on other video platforms other than YouTube, and one of them is Rockfin, and my account has gotten nuked. All the videos, everything is gone, so I have no idea what's going on. Hopefully it's just a small snafu, but yes. The Tech Archons are kind of busy with us today, but we shall persevere. And then good to see everybody. I see Graham Pong in the chat. Hey, Graham. Mr. Daniel Hopkins, one of the greatest minds when it comes to uniting Buddhism and Gnosticism, and other figures. I hope if you have any questions, as always, please super chat them to Vance so we can get to them. And as always, I know there's a good conversation in the chat every time with some amazing, bright minds. So, yeah, not much else. Housekeeping, as always, please support this show in any way you can. I could surely use your help. This year has been a little rough, but I know things will get better. But yeah, please support this show so we can continue bringing you that gnosis and a lot of great content coming in March and a lot of exciting news. So I'm very grateful for those of you who keep this Red Pill cafeteria open. So David, why don't we get to the book. Tell us how you came to write this, your newest book.
So Marco Daffy, the teachings from which I wrote the book upon, in which I include sections from his material, I became aware of in the 90s. He wasn't a writer per se. He didn't, he didn't write to create a following and to express his literary needs. He mostly wrote diaries and letters about what was occurring in his internal laboratory. And the quality of the information of this gnosis is uncomparable to anything in any language. So I became aware of the little booklets that had his name on it that were released by a publisher in Genoa, Italy, in the 80s, that specialized in this form of internal alchemy, which is called alchemical hermeticism, which is different from the spagyric kind or the laboratory kind that uses external substances and materials as its base material, as the materia prima. In alchemical hermeticism, the object and the subject is one and the same thing. So the materials, the chemistry, the minerals that are that are transformed is the subject matter, is the consciousness of the alchemists themselves. As I mentioned earlier, there was a few booklets that had his name on it that were released in the 80s in which I got a hold of. And it just blew my mind in terms of the depth of the knowledge and the details. It was somebody who clearly wasn't writing based on what he had read from other writers in the genre, but someone who did the actual laboratory work, that internal laboratory. And it became the base material for my own inner quest. So that's basically how I became acquainted with this alchemist called Marco Daffy, which isn't his birth name. Marco Daffy is the name that he encountered, or which he became aware of when he did these inner journeys and these inner quests this kind of Gnostic jump from the release or escape from the corporal matrix to this astral realm, where he and through the teachings of his master, which is a famous Italian hermeticist called Giuliano Kremertz. Okay. It gave him a series of rituals to be able to do some explorations into his psyche to determine who define that materia prima, who is the basis of this individual that has this historical incarnation as the Baron Ricciardo Ricciardelli, which is what his birth name. He was born to one of the richest families in Italy, that had number of different owned land across central and southern Italy. And so that was sort of like the context in terms of how I became aware of him. It's just through his laboratory work that was released in booklets. And just once I read this information, I was just blown away by the the depth and the knowledge that he brought to his alchemical and esoteric work. It's just something unparalleled that I've come across, and I've done quite a bit of study in this area. So that was essentially the genesis in terms of my interest in writing this book. Is like, not only did I want to put together a compilation of his material, but make sense of it in terms of, from an esoteric perspective, was of the importance of this material, and to bring to light this initiatic practice that he put together, which I call magical heroism. Mm-hmm. So the hero in the archetypal form that goes through the underworld to find out, you know, their destiny, find out who they are, to deal with their shadow world, to deal with their karmic issues, and to be able to release from them, to detach from those impediments that are limiting them from realizing, from self-realization, and then going through this purgation, this purgatorio, to be able to complement or to release from the vices, and to complement the vices with virtues. And then there's an ascension to self-realization, the paradiso or the paradise. So it follows very much the hero's trajectory of going inside oneself to discover oneself, to deal with those areas of darkness in the unconscious, to bring them to astral light, to the white astral, and then to be able to transform the lead, which is the fallen individual, into the purified individual, the individual, what Jung would call self-individuation, as right. The platform or as the basis to realize into the gold, into that rubedo, which is to realize one's archetypal self. And hence the archetypal name for Baron Ricciardelli was Marco Daffy. That's who he identified in his gnosis, is who he was, the archetypal interior and anterior self or noumen to the historical figure of Baron Ricciardelli.
That's really well said. Great summary and excellent. Yeah, you covered so much. And for the audience, you should check out our last interview with David, where we talk about the Italian Hermetic tradition, which is very rich. We focus on Giuliano Kremitz. But yeah, this was going on, as you write, in the 19th, early 20th century. And it was a very exciting time for the esoterica, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was so much going on, and there are all these different streams. You know, in the French, you had Fulcanelli. In the English-speaking world, you had Crowley. In Italian, you had Kremitz and Daffy. In the Portuguese, I guess you had Fernando Pessoa. There were so many different currents and different pathways, and that's what I'm finding interesting, is not only the similarities, but also what really differentiates one ray of an initiatic light from another. They all lead to the same sun, but the trajectory, that hypotenuse that gets there, in some cases, is different.
Yeah, and I think I love what Daffy was saying, because he really does tap into that Hermetic Gnostic spirit, which is, we are all connected. We are all gods in the awakening, if you say. And we all have this spark of the divinity that we're waking up. The universe is housed in us, just as we're housed in the universe. So he was really tapping into some very primordial, even pre-Renaissance theology.
Yeah, and it's one thing to make those claims and statements. It's another thing to actually map out the process to realize that. And that's what's found in this book, that Daffy does articulate this gnosis practice, this gnosis process of how an individual, starting in their corporal or historical self basis, can sublimate their consciousness to be able to channel into these astral realms where the matrix of time, space, and causality is much more fluid than in the state of relativity that we find ourselves in a historical context. So for him to articulate the pathway and the means to arrive at that, but also once you get there, what do you do? How do you use this channel for evolution, for transformation? And that's what I find is the gold of the book, is that he's able to articulate that in clear manner, how to do that self-transformation and how to address the black astral or the underworld, the area of our shadows, of our unconscious, to come to terms with it, to purge it, to purify it, and then to find the path for what one can, like the ibis, to be able to rise from the flames and into a higher dimension of the self than what one found oneself at the start of this journey.
And what would you say are some of the key features of Daffy's magical system? So we can.
Yeah, I think, I think that there's without a doubt, there's some overlapping with your traditional alchemical process in terms of that the first step in any type of inner transformation is one needs to find the primary matter. Mm-hmm. So one needs to, you know, where does one start from one's historical self? That's typically what psychology does. But we know that's just the surface level. That's just where our level of consciousness, we're working from that area, which is sort of like the tip of the iceberg. Whereas in the esoteric world, it believes it goes right to the source, to the core. So the materia prima or the primer matter is to be able to sublimate one consciousness through meditation or rituals or prayer to be able to separate, to release oneself from all those accretions from societal conditioning, family conditioning, ancestral conditioning, to that state of awareness, of consciousness that is at the most irreducible element of the self. So when we're able to reach that state where we detach from ourselves from all these associations of ourselves, of our ego, of our sense of who we are, and we're just pure awareness, that's the base. That's the primary matter. And from there, it's sort of like, so what do you do with that? You do other type of rituals to be able in that heightened state of perception, of noumenal awareness, is to be able to enter into these other streams of consciousness, this astral stream, and still be lucid, still be have a positive or an active spirit to oneself and to one's light, not just be like a zombie who just witnesses all these things that are occurring in dream states and hyper reality states, but actually to be a willful participant. So that is sort of like the starting point of this journey, of this, what I call this magical heroic pathway that Daffy articulates in alchemical hermeticism.
Yeah, and he's got quite a big toolbox, and I'm sure he probably had different people with different needs as in other systems. I think some of them that I wrote down a lot of notes on the book and on Daffy, but for example, past life regression was important to him, wasn't it?
Well, past life regression, Miguel, was what he received in the 1920s when Kremers was still alive. Daffy went to visit Kremers and explained to him his existential conditioning, which he had marital issues and difficulty dealing with the opposite sex. He was in arranged marriage with a Countess de Sordis, and there was great expectations for Daffy to do something in his life to you know, make the family proud, to combine, you know, these two noble families into one. But Daffy, that wasn't his mission in life. He was feeling constrained in this family relationship, and he sought out a psychologist who happened to be the leader of the local chapter of the Fraternity of Miriam. The Fraternity of Miriam was a magical circle, hermetic chain that was founded by Giuliano Kremertz, who was sort of like the Crowley of Italy. Mm-hmm. And so in the 1920s, Daffy went to this doctor who happened to be the head of this circle of the fraternity, the magical fraternity, the Miriam, and asked about how he can address his issues that he's having with his family, with specifically with his wife, and so the leader wasn't able to provide Daffy with much help. So he introduced Daffy directly to Kremertz, and it was sort of like the conjunction between two heavenly bodies. It was sort of like this atomic release of energy, and Kremertz quickly realized that Daffy had this extraordinary noumenal perception, and he had this extraordinary knowledge of esoteric matters without ever being in a esoteric order himself or doing in proper formal initiatic work. So Daffy explained to Kremertz his issues, and Kremertz provided him with a ritual in terms of that the issue that he has wasn't of the surface. Psychology would not be able to address it. And back in the 20s, you know, Freudian psychology was really at its infancy, and Jung was still doing his experiments. So it didn't tap into the depth that Kremertz was able to diagnose, that this issue that he had was ancestral, in fact, noumenal, and that he provided Daffy with this with these series of rituals that help him to go into himself and understand what some of these archetypal forces that were leading to this imbalance that he had. And the result that Daffy realized in the Kremertzian constitution of the angel, there are four bodies or vibrational frequencies. The corporal is called the Saturnian. The one that affects our emotions is called the lunar. The intelligence is called the mercurial, and the archetypal is called the solar. So between the interrelationship between Daffy and Kremertz, it was realized that Daffy was deficient in his lunar body. It was unbalanced, and that there was a karmic infirmity that he needed to understand. So these rituals that Daffy provided were what we would call today past life regressions, the ability to go into these altered states of consciousness and to be active, to be lucid in recording and interacting with these images and figures that came up. So what Daffy recorded in these investigations in his inner laboratory, that in a past life, he was a priest to an Egyptian temple,
right,
solar temple, where he had an illicit relationship with the pharaohs or the Ptolemy's wife, and also that he misappropriated certain assets of it. And this led to a curse, or led to a deficiency in his lunar body, the body that controls love and relation and emotional relationships, what we call these days emotional intelligence. And that created an offsetting. So by this time, Kremertz had died, and Daffy was at his wit's end. He was able to diagnose what the issue is based on these archetypal representations, like when we have in dreams, when you have similar patterns appearing. Then he was able to summarize that there were two karmic infirmities. One, there was a misappropriation of assets, and one, there was an illicit affair with the pharaoh of the solar temple. Mm-hmm. So he After Kermit's death, he further interacted with this Egyptian order, which is this body of 12 hierarchs that oversees this italic form of initiation that goes back hundreds of years and even to the time of the Iseum of Pompeii. So they provided Daffy with a psychurgic ritual, a ritual that would help him to enter into these relationships, to detach himself or to make amends with these two karmic affirmities by detaching from those disturbed vices and replacing them with the corresponding virtues. And part of the psychurgic releasing from this karmic curse was that he had to expropriate himself of his wealth, which he inherited, and that he had to make amends for this illicit love affair through some form of erotic retribution. So that was the remedy to the psychological and impediments that he was dealing. In the meantime, in the 30s, that Kremertz came along with, but not Kremertz, Daffy came along with Kremertz's grandson, and where there was, and where Daffy, to rid himself of this curse, was providing Kremertz's grandson with his wealth. And his Daffy's wife, the Countess de Sordis, got wind of this and called the cops, and there was a trial. They made the front pages called the Trial of the Magus, where Daffy's wife brought Kremert's grandson to court, and the prosecution deemed Daffy to be insane, that he was, you know, handing over the family riches to this, to Kremert's grandson, who was only a teenager at this time. So to make a long story short, Kremert's grandson, this Trial of the Magus resulted in Daffy's wife winning the case. Kremert's grandson ended up in prison, and Daffy was put under psychiatric overview. But he was still, at this point, he realized that there was a common theme that you know, that initiates, special hermeticists, are never understood by the general public. That the rituals that he was practiced, when it was revealed to the courthouse, they didn't understand it. They thought, this is madness. But as a true hermeticist, that this was, in fact, what was helping him. And so, to make a long story short, the trial itself provided the release from these karmic infirmities, because it allowed Daffy to work in his laboratory on alone, without all the pressures of his family, and to pursue the next phase, which was the purgence, which was that purgation of integrating his purified or his resolved inner self, psyche, and then as the basis for him to self-realize into. And that is the basis of the material that he wrote after the war in the 50s and the 60s that are included in the book, The Alchemical Hermeticism. So it articulates the process to enter into this inner space, to be able to address one's infirmities, to purify from oneself, to do these psychurgic rituals, which are trials, which is, again, going into these dreamlike states and seeing how one interacts and the images and the scenarios that unfold, that in fact what one has actually cleared oneself of these past crimes or these past infirmities, or whether one still needs to do further work of purgation. So that's what psychurgy is the weighing of the soul. And through these rituals, these psychurgic rituals, he realized that he had actually released himself of these, and he had liberated himself for a future incarnation to be born as a much higher individual, as a much higher psyche that is free of these impediments that brought his, that didn't allow him to self-realize into that noble state, which was his, he felt as his destiny or as his ancestral mandate.
Great example of the ritual and how the magic system works. So I was thinking, so in a past life, you had a priest who stole the Pharaoh's money and wife. Did he fix his karma, or then decades later, did he reincarnate as L. Ron Hubbard and then steal the money and the wife from Jack Parsons?
Well, I mean, let's put this in context, Miguel. The actually psychurgic rituals will appear in my next book called The Hermetic Book of the Dead. So, so that's something to look forward to. But let's make sense of this, you know, these past life regressions, you know, going into the past and seeing himself as a priest of this temple of the sun. This is what these are the images that project itself from his unconscious. So whether they have historical validity or not, they have psychurgic validity.
Right.
And that's the basis at the unconscious level that projects itself onto the conscious level. So that's the forces that led to his infirmity, that he had issues with dealing with his wife, had issues interacting with women. He was tended to be a loner. He tended to be very introverted. So all these like innate qualities that he had determined from the youth, he couldn't explain, that this alchemical hermetic framework provided him with the answers. So when we look at, you know, what does this mean? It's spectral representations of his unconscious projecting into his conscious or into his astral consciousness, his dreamlike state, that go deeper than what any type of external psychological discourse would allow to tap into. That's how I make sense of it.
It makes perfect sense. Vance, let's bring you in. Do you have any questions or questions from the audience?
Yeah, we do have a super chat question. In fact, don't we have two? Yes, we have two. Here's an easy one. Got to go over here. Did Daffy and Evola know about each other?
So in the book, Daffy writes about Evola, that he didn't consider Evola as fully realized, that he felt that Evola was more of a scholar than someone who dirtied his hand in the works. He obviously appreciated the material that Evola wrote about, specifically the Hermetic tradition, the books on the on introduction to magic of your group and so forth. But and so both Daffy and Evola were based in Rome in the 20s and 30s. So the people of the Cremercian order and of the Egyptian order, they knew each other. But and in the book, I include some of the testimonies of Daffy's, one of Daffy's disciple named Gian Maria, who was first introduced to Evola. And he found Evola to be playing like the wise man, you know, with lots of airs and so forth, and surrounded by sycophants, whereas Daffy was much more down to earth, that didn't have these airs, which is another testimony to Daffy's balance, for balancing out his lunar body, his emotional body, that he didn't have these airs of superiority. And even though he was considered an erudite, a scholar, he lectured at some of Rome's famous academies that go back to to the Renaissance time, like the Academy of the Lynx or the Tiberine Academy. And he would lecture on at various aspects of metapsychism, of dream interpretation, of mythology, etc. So, and I include a number of different testimonies as well that really counter the judicial rendering of Daffy's being as being insane is that he was actually very lucid. He just was misunderstood. Like most famous hermeticists in the past, whether it's Cagliostro or whether it's Apuleius back in Roman times, the profane don't understand them. So they label them as crazy, as dangerous, as to be feared. But a true hermeticist, you know, takes his process, his methodology right to the end. And so it's, and Daffy wrote, it's a question of misunderstanding, is that, you know, the profane can't understand the sacred because they haven't been in there. They're not exposed to it. They don't know that. So they relativize what they're doing by saying it's dangerous, that it's nonsensical, that it's irrational. Whereas what he's working from is a transrational. He going into aspects of the psyche, investigating that previously haven't been investigated. And of course, those who can't relate to that are going to say this is fantasy. This is a madman who's, you know, barking up a tree, who's, you know, barking at the moon.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay. Also, from Richard Ruach, I don't understand the question myself, but I'm hoping you do.
Are the bodies created already there? And does the work coat the bodies like Gurdjieff says, or are you just integrating these energies? So the bodies are just ways to classify vibrational frequencies. So the bodies aren't just human. It's all nature has in various aspects based on the frequency of the energy, whether it coagulates in a corporal layer, which is a Saturnian, at a more refined layer, the energy vibrates into emotional settings, and then a deeper layer, where the vibrational frequency is much finer, is at an intelligent layer. And then at the archetypal layer is what the intersection between the divine and the profane. So at that archetypal layer, which again isn't visible to most individuals, it has to be experienced. So the bodies are just means to explain the integration as an entity, which we are, that we are comprised of four different types of vibrational frequencies. And for a lot of people, they're not in harmony. So that's why if you find people who are out of sorts with themselves, because they're not able to harness those energies in an efficient and effective means.
Okay.
That answer your question, Richard? And do they relate with Gurdjieff's? God, I haven't read Gurdjieff in decades, so I can't really say, but it's the same issue about awakening, that most people are at a Saturnian level. They react to forces that their external senses are able to organize, whereas someone who is aware of what's going on the outside and on the inside, and are able to be not passive spectators, but are able to change themselves from the inside out.
Yeah, it's well, there are many traditions that approach that process, I guess, in different ways.
Yeah.
Priest Temple of the Sun, do you think he was tapping into Akhenaten and, you know, the original Egyptian monotheism, you know, of ancient Egyptian?
Yeah, I think these what I call spectral representations, these past life regressions, where he would go into these dreamlike states and then he would visualize these scenarios where he was a he could recognize. So in the book, there's a testimony of Daffy and Jemmeria doing one of these rituals. And then after the ritual, Daffy asked Jemmeria, what did you experience? And he said, I experienced that there was two columns that looked like a temple. And there was someone who was dressed like a priest that vaguely looked like you. They had a beard and so forth. So these are again, the unconscious projecting out these coagulated forces of images and scenarios. So they're at an archetypal level rather than a historical. That's how I choose to make sense of it. So whether it's tapping into Akhenaten or it's just how his inner psyche makes sense of these internal forces that haven't manifest themselves in a conscious way, but are symptomatic in his current psychological predicament. Yeah. That when he's able to tap into it, he's representing it in this Egyptian context. But somebody else may represent it in the American Revolution or represent it in the Italian Renaissance. It's just how his psyche processes and configures and articulates these unmanifested forces into a manner that in a dream state he can make sense of and be active and participant.
Did he understand it that way?
That's how he understood it. That's how he understood it. Yeah.
Okay.
Makes sense. Well, cool. Yeah. Again, thanks for those.
But also, I should say he was a firm believer in reincarnation. And so he talks about the various aspects of reincarnation for those who are able to find their noumen, their soul, that they can reincarnate into a higher a psychological evolution. Those who aren't, then they reincarnate as at the same level, or those who, like most of humanity, who aren't able to recollect their soul or to come to terms with their souls and to integrate their memory with it, that they become with the release of their physical body, their energetic core just dissolves and it gets absorbed by the universal spirit. So one of the missions of initiate is to find them their core of who they are, that archetypal self, and to shift their center of gravity of their being from their historical self, which is perishable, to their archetypal self. And this is more readily available in the astral plane, where the laws of time, space, and causality are much more fluid, where the density of the energy is much less than in the state of relativity of the three dimensions that we're most familiar with in a corporal setting. So part of the mission is one needs to be able to do this type of alchemy, inner alchemy, to ensure that in a future incarnation, one can remember who one was and to continue that state of evolution.
Doesn't he talk too about the idea of the siren? Is that someone who can incorporate the four bodies and, as you say, be a true psychonaut where you're just...
Exactly. So the siren is a term that Daffy uses to represent the pilot of the four worlds, of the four bodies. So the four bodies is the individual who's starting off from the historical self, Miguel, Vance, Dave, we're currently in this corporeal self and we're pretty much talking as historical figures. That's a starting point, starting from our Saturnian body. The siren is a hybrid creature, half human, half mythical, half divine. So what that represents is the individual, the initiate, who's able to sublimate their consciousness to this astral plane to find their solar being, their archetypal self, and to be able to, in a lucid, active manner, to be active in the astral plane, to continue these internal alchemy in this astral state that is much more conducive for transformation than on the corporeal state or the historical self. So the siren is a name that Daffy coins for the initiate who's able to realize their archetypal self and to be active in an astral state for inner transformational practices and processes.
Makes sense. And
hence the hybrid. So he's not divulging himself of his physical being. He has the ability to tap into the astral plane and access his archetypal self, which is Marco Daffy, but also to come back into the historical or the corporate plane and to be Baron Ricciardelli. So that's the siren is a hybrid, half mythological figure, divine figure, half human figure.
Yeah,
and the fish, it represents the astral sea. So that's the symbolism behind it, which is different from the avatar. And I explain that in the book.
Exactly. Another thing that Daffy writes a lot about is divination. And again, he used a lot of, or he employed a lot of mediumistic capabilities or instruments like the tarot, I Ching, numerology, dream interpretation, everything. And you also talk about astronology. Could you tell the audience about that, or how did Daffy change from traditional divination?
Yeah, so these instruments that you reference, Miguel, these are part of the toolkit that as initiate, as this navigator of the four tetrads that he used, that passed on from Kremers and from this Egyptian order. And so Daffy found that once he was able to tap into this astral world, that he had greater noumenal apperceptions, that his insights were deeper than they were when he was in the corporal world as Baron Ricciardelli, but also foresight. So his visional faculties grew and became much more richer. And that hence, he developed these oracular faculties to be able, using various instruments like the I Ching or the tarot cards, to be able to get a greater insight and foresight to his predicament and to help others as well. So that Daffy writes about when one enters into this initiatic realm, that one has developed these powers of insight and foresight, that one sees things farther reaching and deeper, you know, to the causal root. And, you know, in Hermeticism, back to the Corpus Hermeticum itself, that, you know, it's all about visions. You know, it's all about, you know, Poimandris or Asclepius appearing to the initiate or to the mist. And that's the lower self. It's all the one individual, the higher self, one's archetypal self, appearing to one's historical self. So it's Marco Daffy appearing to Baron Ricciardelli. It's the same. It's why it's so coherent. It's just written in a very much more modern context then. But it all falls into place to traditional Hermetic practices.
So these tools weren't so much to find out if you're going to win the lottery, but they were tools of inner exploration.
No, they were for that as well. Jean Maria writes that Daffy had a very good winning streak in using some of these instruments to predict horse races, to predict lotteries. He said they were above average. I mean, he didn't win every time, but even the gods don't win every time. You know, the gods lose as well. So it's It was used for practical purposes, but primarily those faculties, those powers were developed as a result of him working in the inner laboratory and getting this greater sense of inner space, this understanding how truths are created at this ethereal level and play out in the four bodies at a corporal level, at an emotional level, an intelligent level. So he had a great understanding of the connectivity of how these principles condescend and realize itself into the state of relativity of three dimensions.
Makes sense. Vince, do you have a question or what do you think so far?
Interesting. There, I think it's very parallel to a lot of other spiritual, disciplines and so forth. The search for self. Not all of them, of course. The Orthodox, religions with their beliefs and you have to believe in what the priest says and just sit there in church on Sundays or synagogue or whatever. That's totally aside. That they don't really encourage any individual development, any individual spiritual development, really. So. It's a lot in common with Gnosis, I suppose, as well. Gnostics believed in reincarnation, right? And inner journeys and so forth. So, I was wondering, I was going to ask how it changed, how it changed his life, but you've already addressed that, how it relates to the physical world as well as the other worlds. But one burning question is, when we refine ourselves to such a degree, I imagine, the precipitation of the solution and everything in alchemy, what's really going to be left? When we drop away our, caring about how to get a loaf of bread and what the neighbor is doing and, our very language, our culture, when all that drops away, we become pure consciousness, is there anything to care about at that point? What are we aware of? What are our memories? What memories make sense? What memories are significant anymore?
Okay, that's a great question, Ben. So Daffy, in one of the articles called Initiation and Neo-Buddhism, where he makes a case for Westerners not to give up their Western initiatic traditions, but to really find the sources of them. And after, it was written after the war when, Eastern religions, whether it was Hinduism or Buddhism or Tibet, were taking over and they were promoting themselves as, salvation for all the ills that Westerners have and so on and so forth. And Daffy writes about that, this leads to an alienation, that the traditions in the Western hemisphere, the ones that are true and time bound, like the Pythagorean or Hermetic traditions, that they do offer a path to self-realization without giving up the material world. So when we talk about the integration of the four bodies, we're not saying one has to, give up the Saturnian body, that the Saturnian body is the foundation of the higher ones. Of the, the mercurial and solar ones, and that the path for this Hermetic tradition isn't about, isolating oneself in a cave and meditating on one's navel, so one rids oneself of the body, but is to transform the Saturnian energy, to sublimate it, to channel it up to your solar level. So that is the goal of Western initiation. It's a transformation of an integration of Saturnian energy or corporal energy to refine it, to distill it, so it becomes nutrition for the solar body. So one doesn't need to give up. One doesn't need to give up one's personality, one's profession, one's mission in life in the physical realm. But one needs to realize the physical realm is the perishable, but underlying it is the solar, which doesn't perish with the disintegration of the physical body, that it becomes latent and it becomes a seed that will germinate in a future time. And the true initiate who's developed these past life and these memory type of remembrance practices is able to connect into that. into that unified energy fields of the solar body. So that's the answer, is that the physical realm is the energy, the gross energy that one requires to aliment, to feed and nourish the solar body, which is our eternal souls.
That's an interesting, that's definitely diapose to Buddhism, for example, which seems to, in at least my estimation, the kind like the certain types of Buddhism, at least, leads into dissolution and, you know, annihilation.
The soul, exactly.
Right.
Individuality of the soul. So there's quite an extensive dissertation in the book on the soul development. And the various types of souls. And I do encourage the audience who are interested to read up on that. And you'll find some very poignant solutions that help to differentiate this Western practice of Hermeticism from some of the Eastern solutions. And that the soul, or what they call the noumen, can coexist with the universal spirit. So we know in Buddhism, or in certain forms of Buddhism and Hinduism, it's sort of like, you know, the soul is an illusion, and it's, you know, samadhi is the goal, where you just absorb into the universal spirit. Whereas in Hermeticism, the personal self, it's in, again, the dialogues in the Corpus Hermeticum, where the higher self, the mind, is referred to God, and the individual mind is referred to the Son of God, and it's all light. So they can coexist. So the individual psychic light does not necessarily have to extinguish itself with the passing of the physical body. It can still remain as a universal quantum of energy, a coagulation of energy that can germinate. And there's a continuation. So I encourage the audience who find this level of discussion interesting to pick up the book and to explore that, because you'll find some very surprising solutions to perhaps some of these type of ontological issues and problems that have been posited in esotericism and in religion that addresses those questions in a very lucid and rational way.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, the book has so much and it covers so much. I'm sure the church must have been very happy with these Italian alchemists, right, David? And yeah, just we know what they thought. And I know we talked about it last time, but it's always a topic people are interested. How did these occultists do under El Dulce?
It's funny you mentioned that. So actually, whether it was Daffy or even Evola,
Evola did well.
Yeah. So it's complex. So in the 20s, when Mussolini came to power, there was no sense that he would become this like authoritarian regime. It was sort of like to restore. It's sort of like what Trump. It's restore, make Italy great again, to restore the Roman Empire. So there was a sense of hope. There was a sense of that there's tapping into this reservoir that was abandoned for centuries, for millennia, that there's this rebirth, this renaissance. But in the 30s, you know, as these black shirts, like most authoritarian regimes, started to clamp down on free speech and so forth, it became very repressive. So initially, like Daffy and Evola, there was hope. And then they realized the true nature. And, you know, they had to be careful because, you know, Mussolini clamped down on Freemasonry and so on and so forth. And there was association that the Miriam was a Masonic order, even though it wasn't, because it was really a hermetic chain of initiates. It wasn't connected to any of the international Freemasonry bodies of the time. So it initially went from hope to skepticism to this is just pure regression. And then when, Mussolini aligned himself with the church, it was sort of like there was hostilities from initiates that this was, strangling the rebirth of this ancient spirit.
No, that makes sense. And if you had to say what is maybe the gift or the legacy of Daffy on the world, what would you say? Or has it only just begun, as the carpenter said?
Well, I would say what really, and I mentioned it in probably in the opening sentence of my book is that Marco Daffy has differentiated himself from the pantheon of magical heroes for his quest and his explorations of inner space, of this astral realm. So not many people talk about going into these other realms and talk about, their encounters, but not many are able to articulate a process to arrive at that. So I think what really differentiates Daffy from a lot of other initiates is the detail in terms of how he's able to provide a roadmap into inner space, into the journey to find one's inner self, one's archetypal self, and the process and the tools that one needs to be able to transform oneself to become who one is meant to be, that mandate, that purpose in life. So I think that's really the legacy. And it's just his articulation, the clarity he brings to that, the sophistication. He writes in a mythopoetic manner. It's not, dry academia. It's someone who, again, uses terms such as a siren to encapsulate what this inner Argonaut or this inner navigator is. This is a hybrid character. He doesn't give up his human side, but he also has the ability to affirm his divine side. And I think that's really cool.
I agree too. It's like Terry Pratchett said, we are where the fallen angel meets the rising ape. And Hermetic said, yeah, we humans, we have a special responsibility. We're not the gods. We're not animals. We're kind of both.
Yeah.
Excellent. And that's our responsibility. And that's our, it's a great place to be. It's what we are meant to be. So, makes sense. And you said your next book is The Alchemical Book of the Dead?
Yeah, my next book that's coming out by it's published again by Inner Tradition. I think next year at this time will be called The Hermetic Book of the Dead.
Can't wait.
And it's on some of these rituals and methods to be able to recall one's past life, to recall one's Newman or one's archetypal self. And it writes about reincarnation and other forms of post-mortem that initiates or the public are need to be aware of. It talks about practical experiences that I've had and some other initiates have who are connected with the Fraternity of Miriam. So that's something to look forward to. I've got an article, two articles that are coming out in next month with New Dawn called Marco Daffy, the Hermetic Avatar. So to check that out. Also an article that's coming out in a magazine called Zazen Sounds. Mm-hmm. And setting up a Hermetic Chain of the Miriam as well, for those who want to become familiar with these practices, want an outlet to practice as a means to be able to experiment, to experience some of these practices firsthand. So, and a couple of other books that I'm working on in translation and writing on my own as well. So trying to stay busy, guys.
Good.
It's cold here in Toronto. We had a terrible winter.
Yeah, it was very cold. I hear you. George Harrison sang, "Here comes the sun." It's going to get here, David. Don't worry. Yeah, but yeah, keep writing. Keep writing. We love your work, and it's very important. And yes, I have an article coming out too in the same issue of New Dawn, David. So we'll be
all right. So we'll be neighbors.
Yeah,
awesome.
We'll be article neighbors. So we'll help somebody. Vance, any last question or remark before we turn all this lead to gold?
Well, I just wanted to shout out to Harry, who gave a super sticker earlier without a question. So thank you, Harry.
Thanks, Harry.
And any last question I'd have probably keep us another hour. So
what's the meaning of life?
Oh, yeah. And all sorts of other things. And what's it like? What are the rituals like? Do you need a facilitator? Can you do it by yourself? Those types of questions is interesting.
So are you asking me, Vance, or is this?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, I'll give that.
Rituals are the Miriam rituals are different from what Daffy's doing. Miriam rituals. So the Miriam is an Isaic order, a lunar order about purification. So it's basically dealing with the nigredo and the albedo. So the black phase and the white phase. So it's a order, it's a practice, it's a rite that focuses on how one can enter into initiation. So initiation being an inner path, and how one can come to terms with some of these psychic issues, some of these karmic issues that we may not be aware of because of repression, or we just don't have the knowledge, or we don't have the understanding of what's going on, why I am the way I am. So the Miriam is a therapeutic order about using magnetism, using internal energy to identify who we are at an occult level. So it's very much working with the fluid body. As I mentioned earlier, the fluid body is the integration of the lunar, the mercurial, and the solar self, and to come to terms with one's shadows, with one's karmic issues, to correct them, to purge from them, and to enter in a more purified and sublimated aspect of the self. So it's very much what they call an Isaic or lunar self about purification. And it deals with magnetism to be able to cultivate good, pure, pristine energy and to project that to those who need it, whether it's yourself or family members or those who are going through difficult times. So there's this whole energy that one taps into. The Miriam is a state of being. It's a state of archetypal purity. It's like the Mother Mary. It's a matrix for this arriving at this state of purity that hasn't been diluted or compromised with the profane world. So when the initiate's able to tap into that, one of the qualities that develop is a strong magnetism. This energy radiates out, and then one learns how to channel that energy for beneficial means. Oneself, okay. One's family, for others who need it.
Do you need a guide? Could we reconstruct these rituals for our own
benefit? There's a daily practice, and there's practices for certain cycles of the moon. So the moon is, again, it has a strong impact on our emotional body, level of energy. So there are different rituals that are used in conjunction to the various cycles of the moon.
They're self-guiding?
For the most part, they are. So it's as I mentioned, so there are the daily rituals that one can enter and really experience their occult self, but also to be able to with the instructions from the programs that these rituals come accompanied with, to be able to guide oneself to deal with the junk that's haven't been addressed, and that'll happen. And for some people, it's overwhelming. But also to purify, to be able to come to the sense of balance, and to be able to deal with life's issue, and also to be able, as this magnet, to be able to project those energies in a beneficial way for oneself or for others. So it's self-guiding in that sense. There are instructions in terms of how to enter into these states and how to deal with some of the circumstances that may result from that. Again, it depends on the participant, the initiate, the level of inner work that they've done. So yeah. And then the other rituals are like what Daffy did. That's a more of an Osiridian level, a solar level that are much more intense and much more complex. And again, that'll appear in my next book.
There you go. Awesome. We look forward to it and check it out, people. Well, we are at the end. Vance, thanks for keeping us company.
Oh, sure. It was great. Enjoyed hearing about this.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Yes, David. Thank you very much. Everybody check out Alchemical Hermetism. David might be the only person in the world without a website, but you can go to Inner Traditions and all those.
Yeah.
He's got a website in the ethereal plane somewhere, so we can't get there right now.
Pretty much so, yeah. You know, if you want to reach me, reach on social media, Facebook, Instagram, or go on the Inner Traditions webpage and just fire a note to them. But I'm pretty available on social media.
Good deal. Well, if you have any questions about these rituals and everything, well, awesome. Well, yeah, we are at the end for the audience. We'll have another guide. Next week, we will be dealing with kind of the same thing, the astral plane. We'll be dealing with machine elves, tricksters, and other denizens of the interdimensional world. But this one, obviously, DMT, ayahuasca kind of entity. So different. So it should be a good show, but it's all sort of connected depending on where you are in your life. So thanks, everybody, for coming. And David, once again, thanks for coming on the show. And as always, we look forward to the next time we can chat.
For sure. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
You bet.
You Take too. Care. And for everybody else, have a good rest of your Sunday and have a great week. And as I always say, you know it. Write your own gospel. Live your own myth. Take care, everybody.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save. Like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.